Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. Before we get into today's show, we wanted to mention this coming Tuesday, September 10th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., we'll present a WAMC Locked Box pre-presidential debate panel special. Joe Donahue will host an extra special evening show as we, WAMC, the listenership, and the country, get warmed up to watch the first presidential debate between sitting Vice President and Democratic candidate Kamala Harris and former President and Republican candidate Donald Trump. To learn more, visit WAMC.org. I'll remind you about that at the end of the show. On Wednesday, September 4th, Joe was joined by Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and the Empire Report's J.P. Miller.
Linda Sun, who worked for both Governor Kathy Hochul and Governor Andrew Cuomo, was accused of using her position to benefit the Chinese government. So, a New York official charged with taking money, travel, and poultry to aid China. So this is a fascinating story that is complicated and is just strange. But Ms. Sun was charged on Tuesday with 10 criminal counts that included visa fraud, money laundering, and other crimes. Her husband, Chris Hu, who is 41 years old, a businessman, is charged in the indictment with money laundering. Both pleaded not guilty in federal court, were released on bond, and were required to surrender their passports. Brian Peace, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, who oversaw the investigation with the FBI, said in a statement that Ms. Sun betrayed the public trust. While appearing to serve the people of New York as deputy chief of staff within the New York State Executive Chamber, the defendant and her husband actually worked to further the interests of the Chinese government and the CCP. Linda Sun's lawyer, Gerald Schaefer, said that Ms. Sun was looking forward to addressing the indictment in court. Our client is understandably upset that these charges have been brought. The accusations, if true, would represent a brazen manipulation of New York State government at the highest level, covering several years of the administrations of Ms. Hochul and Andrew Cuomo, both Democrats. The press secretary for Ms. Hochul said that Ms. Sun was hired by the executive chamber more than a decade ago, adding that the Hochul administration officials immediately reported her actions to law enforcement and have assisted law enforcement throughout the process. He said that the administration terminated her employment in March of 2023 after discovering evidence of misconduct. JP.
Thank you, Joe. You know, anytime there are federal charges brought against a top staffer for the governor of New York or the mayor, it's big news. The newspapers today talk about a brand new Ferrari, a condo in Hawaii, and a $3.6 million Long Island home and lavish spending. From what I read, government officials are required to fill out financial disclosure forms. And Ms. Sun's financial disclosure form showed her government salary and then that her husband did not make any meaningful money, you know, according to that financial disclosure form. The government is alleging that that financial disclosure form is wrong, that they were making millions of dollars. The alleged scheme says basically that Ms. Sun boosted the Chinese government within New York's government apparatus, and in exchange that the Chinese government or officials helped set her husband up with a business exporting lobsters to China. And, you know, the big money did not appear on the disclosure forms. The big money that they allegedly received also did not appear on their tax forms. I guess they didn't pay taxes on this money. What I had a hard time reading, though, is usually when you read about a corruption scandal in New York, it's so-and-so gets paid in exchange for taxpayer dollars from the state or official actions. And New York State doesn't really have much domain over the relationship with China. You know, our federal government has domain over that. I also thought it was interesting that there is a Taiwanese official named Senator John Liu who came to the defense of Linda Sun. And, you know, they allege that she was basically, you know, taking out references to Taiwan in speeches, et cetera. And that Senator Liu says that, you know, she is innocent until proven guilty. There are examples of other prosecutions against Asian Americans where the government does not quite grasp how their culture works, and then those charges are dropped. That's what Senator Liu, a well-thought-of senator, I thought it was interesting that he jumped to her defense and said there's nothing here.
Prosecutors say that Ms. Sun blocked Taiwanese officials from having access to the governor's office, eliminated references to Taiwan from state communications, and quashed meetings between Taiwanese officials and state leaders, including Governor Kathy Hochul, who succeeded Mr. Cuomo and who promoted Ms. Sun to deputy chief of staff. Sarah.
Yeah, I thought actually the Empire Report headline was grabby as well. Hochul furious, I think, was the headline. I always get the Empire Report because
thank you
because what happens in New York is actually a really big deal across the country, right? So we're in really close proximity to one of the major news publications. No offense to anyone here, but the New York Times, right? So people all over the country read that. So. We forget, I think, sometimes being so New York-centric, how important our state is and how important what our officials and their chiefs of staff, deputy chiefs of staff say. So it's a problem not just for Hochul, obviously, but it casts a cloud over the Cuomo administration. Grace Meng, who has been stellar by all accounts. And so it's... It's an uncomfortable story for Democrats, period, at a really crappy time for that kind of a story to come out. That, you know, somebody was getting paid taxpayer dollars to find more taxpayer dollars for personal enrichment. So it also reminds, it's on the heels of the Bob Menendez gold bars story. It's just like we usually think of these things coming out of New Jersey. No offense to New Jersey. It's just we've come to expect
our ratings in New Jersey. Yeah.
None taken.
No. I just, you know, like this is
so Jersey.
This is really Jersey of us. And maybe it's a downstate thing. I'm just going to irritate everybody this morning. But, you know,
it wasn't gold bars. It was ducks.
And a Ferrari and shell companies.
Yes.
And the Taiwanese angle is interesting because she seemed to be interfering with Taiwanese access. So it's just, there's more under this story. I'm sure there's more.
I'm sure.
We'll see more headlines and hopefully not before November.
Bob Griffin, I want to get your thoughts on this story in general. But one of the things that I thought of that I really wanted to ask you specifically is, so you have the administration, the Cuomo administration. This woman had been a part of that administration. Then there's a change in leadership between Governor Cuomo to Governor Hochul. Is there not then another opportunity to check the references and to go back and to see who exactly is being inherited in the switch here?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine there's a whole vetting process, especially in the chamber. And I think this is one of the reasons the governor came out so strongly, because it obviously failed, but at the same time, it's created a great deal of egg on her face, if we could continue with sort of the poultry jokes. For those of you that haven't read the article, was the New York Times article, one of the first things that jumped out at me was the use of the private chef at the from the Chinese consulate was sending salted duck to the family. I'm going to take it a different place though. I think the quid pro quo here, if there is one, and again, it's a presumption of innocence, so I just want to make sure I start with that. Is the denial of access to Taiwan and Taiwanese leaders to New York, New York State, and by proxy, that creates, in my mind, a barrier to trade, a barrier particularly to the financial markets, and more importantly, at the national security level, It's another example of the growing manipulation of China of our critical infrastructures. The idea, and you get to realize how sophisticated the Chinese manipulation is. You know, start to think about social media. You start to think about actually Chinese government's presence in neighborhoods and communities in New York City and in New York State. We see in this charge, it goes all the way up to access into the governor's office. The Chinese influence on in the soft powers are a growing threat to our national security. So I see this as an area to watch for the foreseeable future, as China tries to influence how we as a country feel and think, and if they can deny Taiwan access to it, it certainly helps their position.
And things like letterhead and proclamations, those aren't little things. Those are official government acts.
Given what you just said, Bob, about what we know of the Chinese government, if you are the governor of the other 49 states, what are you doing right now?
I'm going back and I'm asking for a review of everybody's ethics statements. You know, I actually think it's always a good thing. And I've said on the show in the past, Joe, I think that the state ethics rules continue to need a substantive rewrite, refresh, and strengthening.
What ethics rule law would have changed this in fact caught this?
Well, technically I would argue that it was caught because, you know, of the charges. But the, you know, if you're filing an ethics, there's got to be some cross reference that makes some common sense, right? If I'm filing an ethics statement saying all I make is the salary that I get from my tax dollars, I don't have other sources of income or money. But I'm buying I think it was a $3.5 million house on Long Island, a condo in Honolulu. I'm driving a Ferrari. That should trigger something. Okay. And in my mind, that there's an opportunity to think about how we could sort of cross-reference some of those issues. And a lot of times there may be something that is completely innocent. You know, if you've inherited something from your family or, you know, some rationale, but there's got to be a connection between what you file and the state of reality in our ethics rules.
The subject we begin with and we continue with is a New York official charged with taking money, travel, and poultry to aid China. Linda Sun, who worked for both Governor Kathy Hochul and Governor Andrew Cuomo, was accused of using her position to benefit the Chinese government. Bob, the one other follow-up I had before the break that I wanted to ask you before we break out into individual discussion groups is they had already parted ways. The governor and Linda Sun had already parted ways. In March of 2023, she left the administration.
Yes.
We also know from the governor's office that they worked, they reported and worked very diligently with law enforcement to give them any information that they had. So does it make sense that the story is coming out now as opposed to a year ago?
Yeah, because I think what you're dealing with was an ongoing investigation, and Justice finally felt that they had everything that they needed to move forward. The timing is interesting. Sarah, you raised the issue of sort of the specter of it being, you know, close to the election, so everything is highly politicized. I'll also note, I think it was over this weekend, there was another clash between Chinese Navy units in the Philippine Coast Guard that I know our military was watching very closely, or at least that's the reports. I don't know that personally. It was just from open source intelligence. You also are seeing sort of continued growing tension, Joe, with China flexing its muscles closer to the election. So you're seeing not just the tension with the Philippines, but with Vietnam. You're seeing tension with China and India. You're seeing an increase in cybersecurity poking attacks, testing systems. And of course, we know that disinformation is being used not only by China, but Russia and Iran and North Korea and others as we get closer and closer to the election. So this all sort of comes together at a time when the country, I think, is particularly vulnerable to the type of manipulation that she's being accused of.
I want to go back to something that was mentioned prior to the break, that Sun even arranged without proper authorization for Chinese government officials to receive official proclamations, formal framed documents that bear the state seal and the governor's signature. I think many of us know that we don't feel that they have much meaning or is all that special. I mean, they are, but they roll them out at a pretty good clip.
Mm-hmm.
But as stated here and as Bob mentioned, foreign officials hold them in extremely high esteem.
Right. And I know I keep going back to the little things, but this letterhead situation, in the Justice Center, students have to get a couple layers of approval before anything goes out on letterhead. And that's because we're closely supervising them under the limited supervised practice of law. I can't imagine that our office procedures are more strenuous than those in the governor's office. And that's part of the problem here is this specter of shady business at a time when the Democrats nationally are trying to set themselves apart from that sort of political corruption and behavior. It's deeply problematic, and it's a systemic issue with like some really simple solutions that don't need to go to the level of ethics revisions.
Bob?
I don't disagree. It's an interesting story because back to your point about this isn't sort of the classic, but in some respects it's very classic, right? I mean, it's a quid pro quo of money for influence. The difference though is that the influence is different. Joe, and this is just pure speculation, is that I said it was an ongoing investigation between time she was terminated to yesterday's event. When you start sort of wrapping in the international qualities and the international espionage qualities of it, there are cards that there are shoes that haven't dropped on this story yet. So I would think that there's more to the story that is going to come out.
Yeah, there's already emails that are in this news story, quotes from emails, which typically for these high-level investigations, a lot of that stuff is kept pretty secret. So if they're already out there, some how brazen this was, and I think Hochul's spokespeople were very wise to say, we can't believe how aggressively bad this was, although I don't think that sends the message that they think it does in terms of distancing themselves from culpability. But where there's a little bit, there's a lot.
That was Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 4th. We'll be back with more after this break. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 5th, Joe Donahue was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, the Ulster County Comptroller and the former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, and Wall Street investment banker, Mark Whitman.
Let's go to, of course, what I'm referring to, and that is the Georgia high school shooting that took place yesterday. There are details, not a lot, but we know some things. What we know, though, at the core level of this, and I'm probably going to harp on this a lot this morning, but a 14-year-old student, 14 years old, accused of killing four people with a military-style rifle at his Georgia high school. And they questioned him about online threats when he was 13, according to the FBI. Nine people were expected to survive their injuries. Four were killed yesterday. Barely a month into the new school year, the student opened fire with a military-style rifle on Wednesday at the Appalachie High in Winder, Georgia, killing two students and two teachers. He surrendered when confronted by school resource officers, according to the authorities, who said the suspect would be charged with murder. Students described their terror as a lockdown that they initially thought was a drill. It turned out to be anything but. They said they heard gunfire and barricaded themselves in classrooms, then later fled to the football field to reunite with anxious parents. The attack, which also injured eight students and a teacher, stoked fear and anguish in the city of roughly 18,000 people in the exurbs of Atlanta, as the community grappled with a burst of violence that the local sheriff described as pure evil. I would like to get back to that in just a moment. I would like to say that the 14-year-old suspect, Colt Gray, will be prosecuted as an adult, according to the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, who said that the shooter had used an AR platform-style weapon. The authorities were still investigating how he had gained access to the gun. Rifles based on the AR-15 design have been commonly used in mass shootings. It's hard for me. I was listening to the sheriff yesterday during the press conference that they gave in the afternoon, the early afternoon, well, late afternoon, but it was the first press conference that they gave. And the sheriff said this was pure evil and this kid was pure evil. He's 13 years old. I'm sorry, but
it's blaming a person when we really need to be blaming a system.
We have to blame a system, and we have to blame, there's a lot of things, but what led a 13-year-old kid to do this? And I think that's what we have to figure out, instead of taking this kid and making him out to be, quote, pure evil. And I believe there was a statement about that he went before the school resources officers, and he knew whether if he went any further that he would go to hell. Okay, we don't know that, obviously. At the end of the day, he committed murder, and a murder of two students, two teachers, and a lot of injuries. And I certainly don't excuse that in any way, shape, or form. However, I think we have to obviously look at it in a larger picture of how we look at a personification of evil. Mark.
Well, Joe, I think you're right to highlight that pronouncement by the sheriff, because if you centralize the problem in one person, then you can solve it. And once you've solved it, tried him as an adult, you're done with it. It reminds me a lot of what Ted Cruz said after Uvalde. We said, well, you know, you don't have to have gun control. You just need to harden all the schools, have one entrance, and put a security guard, and we're done. As if that would protect all Americans, let alone even all children, from gun violence. The question of what led the child to want to do this is one question. The question of why was he able to do it is easily answered, because we as a society permitted him to have access to a weapon like an AR platform weapon, whatever we're calling them now. And I'll tell you an interesting story, and then I'll pass along for others to comment. I was touring schools. My son has recently changed schools. Someday we can talk about why it is. His previous school couldn't protect him from racism, but that's a whole different question. And as part of the interview, at the end of the interview at one particular school, I asked the school administrator, was there any question I haven't asked that parents normally do? And she looked at me and she said, well, I want to be polite because you're a little bit of an older adult, so maybe this is a generational issue. But all of the parents now ask about active shooter safety drills and procedures. That's how pervasive this, and even in some ways even more importantly, the fear of it, has become in our country now.
It's how pervasive, and the there was video that was taken by students and I believe one teacher of cell phone video as they were marching out to the football field yesterday. And at one point they said, oh, this is the fifth time we've done this. Obviously not under the circumstances, but as a drill in the past, which is, obviously very telling. And it seems early on in these investigations, everyone seems to say, well, things worked out exactly the way we wanted them to. And then over the next two or three weeks, all we do is say, this went wrong, that went wrong, this went wrong, that went wrong. So I'm not going to do that today, but we'll see what the investigation holds. Malia.
I think one of the things that this demonstrates is how difficult it is in under our current system to prevent a mass shooting. So this kid, when he was 13, was interviewed by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They came into the house. They interviewed the kid and the father. Apparently, the father assured the Georgia Bureau of Investigation that the weapons were secured. The child didn't have access to them. And despite that, and obviously that means this child was on law enforcement's radar. He had made threats. They knew he had access to a weapon, even though the parent said he didn't. And despite all that, this tragedy still occurred because, as we heard in the press conference yesterday, there was, I think it was the sheriff who said, there was no probable cause to take any further action beyond the interview they held with him. So they're watching him. They're aware that there's some kind of issue, and they're not able to stop it under our current laws. So that it makes you wonder how many other kids are under surveillance because they've made threats it's disheartening to say the least. I would be surprised, based on what we heard yesterday, if the father doesn't end up being charged in some way, because obviously he said that he was safeguarding these weapons and wasn't allowing access, and yet the kid ended up with the weapon. So there is some trend in holding parents now responsible for the actions of their children, their minor children. I don't know if this is the first time that someone is going to be charged as an adult in that kind of circumstance, but I imagine the father is going to see some kind of charges as well.
You know, I just also, and I want to get to March, obviously, but it is this idea of the school resource officer, and I understand that, and they're the pro-gun side of this discussion that says, well, you take care of the gun problem with guns. I mean, so better would have been a school resource officer killing a 14-year-old? I mean, good God.
Right.
Is that what we've...
that would be traumatizing as well.
Again, I am not by any way excusing the horrific crimes of this 14-year-old kid. However, an eye for an eye when it comes to taking a school resource officer who has to look into the face of a 14-year-old and take him down, I don't know how that works.
In our county, school resource officers are contracted through the sheriff's office. So it's sheriff's deputies that are our school resource officers in most districts. I think the parents being held responsible is where we're going. I agree with Malia on this, and I'm glad to think about it that way. I think they should be. I think parents need to think of themselves on the front line. If you have a child who has real mental health issues and is suffering from depression and anger, it is your responsibility to get your kid help. And it certainly is your responsibility to secure any weapons that you have. What I'm outraged about is we are still having this conversation. I'm so done with this topic. It's like repeat, you know, mass shooting at a school, AR-15, and then people piling on, you know, gun advocates, Second Amendment advocates piling on, saying it's not the time to talk about policies. And Governor Kemp from Georgia said that yesterday. I'm sorry, it is. I disagree with the governor of Georgia. And I just want to note, you know, like the Gifford Center, you know, that's Gabby Gifford's nonprofit that fights gun violence, ranked Georgia as like the 46th worst state in the country for, I should say, one of the worst, one of the worst in the state for gun issues. And he said he wears that as a badge of honor. This is several years ago. So, you know, we have leaders who are accepting this, who are condoning it, and who are then chastising the rest of us for trying to bring solutions to the table when something happens. And that's outrageous.
And do we have to go to break?
You have a half a minute. Go ahead.
I worry about the kids, unlike in a workplace shooting, where, you know, you can work from home sort of indefinitely after that. The kids are going to have to go back into the school. And it's just psychologically traumatizing for them that there are very few other options to help them continue their education. And I don't think we've really dealt with that.
There was a child that was being interviewed last night who said, well, I guess we're going back to school on Monday, I think. We can't go back tomorrow because it's an active crime scene. I mean, my God. And I mean, obviously the kids have to go back to school sometime, but I think we have to work on some of the trauma aspects right. of this as well before we bring it all together. We are talking about a 14-year-old who brought in an AR platform style weapon into school. And Georgia, 4 people killed, 2 students, 2 teachers, and many, many others injured. The shooting was the deadliest episode of school violence in Georgia history, prompted an outpouring of sympathy and outrage. President Biden, in a statement, lamented the attack as another horrific reminder of how gun violence continues to tear our communities apart. We do have letters. Let's get to some of those. So, let me go backwards in the sense of letters that came in first. All right. Byron, why is that our criminal justice, and that's a joke, wants to charge a child who has no sense of who he is yet and certainly is not developed as an adult? To charge him as an adult is wrong. It is cruel. It is unfair. The parents were asleep at the wheel and let their son crash while taking others down with him. That from Byron.
I mean, one of the reasons for charging as an adult is to get harsher consequences, right? Let's be clear. There's outcomes here. That's why they're doing it.
Right. But to the point, is that fair to a 14-year-old who, you know, may or may not have even gone through puberty yet?
I don't think we've heard in any of the reports whether this child, Colt Gray, I guess is his name, got any mental health counseling or anything like that. Like, that hasn't been part of what has been emphasized in the reports about this since the FBI, not the FBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation visited him last year. Like, what has happened in the interim to help?
I was confused on that. I'm sorry, Mark. I was confused on that because the FBI reported that But you're right. It was the Georgia Bureau that had red flagged it.
Right.
Last year.
I think they're the ones who spoke with him and the parent.
And then the FBI, who were giving that information out as of yesterday.
Right.
Look, to have a mass shooting in this country, you typically need a group of people, you need a firearm, and you need a disaffected, young, typically white male. So you're not going to stop groups of people getting together. Even if we stop minting guns today, it'd be 100 years before they'd all get so old they come off the streets. So that's not going to happen. I know it's cliche to say we need to worry about mental health, but what's the harm of making sure that more of these disaffected young white males, particularly those who have an initial brush with the law around threats or threats of using firearms or threats of violence, what's the harm of making sure that they get better
right.
care?
Like, what else happened? The GBI is like, we flagged him, we couldn't arrest him. There was no probable cause to arrest him. And so, like, and that's the end of the story until the shooting happened? I mean, it's...
Right, we don't know. We don't know yet what the investigation will turn up. But this is the 385th mass shooting this year in the United States. That's 1.5 mass shootings a day. Not school-related. School-related, 32 school-related in K-12 campuses and 13 on university and college campuses. That's just school shootings in general, not necessarily mass. So it's a huge problem everywhere. I'm overwhelmed that we haven't crafted not just one solution, but like a multitude of policy initiatives on this.
And the thing that seems obvious to me is you have to have insurance when you have a car. When they mint one of these guns, they should start to form an insurance fund. And if you want to have the insurance be a one-time when the first buyer has to pay it or it's an ongoing obligation, I don't care. But at a minimum, when these things happen, we as a public should have the wherewithal to go into that school, provide everybody the necessary counseling, clean up, and do the best we can. You know, even for the parents of the deceased, obviously you can't bring people back. But 20 years on, when somebody asks an individual who witnessed or was part of the community, gee, how do you feel about it? And they say, look, we can never get the loss back, but at least we took care of everything else that we could. We're not even in that position in this country.
Richard writes, please recant the statement blaming the individual as opposed to blaming the system. I say, please blame the individual. The kid was obviously smart enough to evade the FBI's inquiries and smart enough to get his dad's gun. Blame him and the parents. Treat him as an adult and set a new precedent with the death penalty. I don't know what good that does. And I understand your point. But I also don't know if you blame the individual. Yes, of course. I mean, he's the one who's going to be charged. So, yes, he's being blamed. That does make sense. So I don't think we're saying that. But there is a system to be blamed, or we wouldn't have the number that March just read of how many of these shootings we have in our country in just a year's time.
Well, the other option is to just put a loaded firearm by the bedside of every 14-year-old and have them act on impulse and just blame them when it happens. I mean, the letter writers, I mean, I'm obviously making an extreme point. It's silly. It's this society that gave him access to that gun. And if you don't believe it, just look across the ocean to the United Kingdom, where if he had those impulses, he'd be lucky to get a hold of a knife of a certain length, which are also illegal to carry in the UK on the street.
I'm the one who commented on the system, blame the system, not the individual. And I'm not saying don't blame the individual. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying as we look to solutions, we have to look broader than just pointing a finger at one child and saying that they're evil. We have to look at the entire system.
Well, the student is being charged, and the kid will be charged with murder. I mean, so whether he's charged as an adult or as a minor, still going to be charged with murder.
And death penalty-wise, I'm just not here for it. Why do we kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong? I can't get behind it.
And exactly. There's also a PS to that letter, which was, and I unfortunately clicked off of it, so I don't have it right in front of me, but the PS was that the school officer did not have to shoot and kill the student. He could have just injured the student. But my understanding is that all law enforcement is to shoot to kill.
Yeah,
right?
Well, that speaks of it. The writer, the letter writer should go educate themselves about a lot of things, including the use of lethal force. No one who shoots a firearm is so good that they can reliably wound but not kill, which is why when you tell law enforcement or people who are rightfully defending themselves with a firearm, if you got to use it, hit the body mass so that you can solve the problem, because trying to nick an ear is not a reasonable technique.
Joe, I was horrified to read accounts of parents who rushed to the scene and couldn't, because of the traffic being stopped and roads being closed, couldn't get there, had to park their cars in ditches and on the sides of the road two miles away and run to the site. And I just, my heart breaks for those parents, and just think about how that would feel here and what extreme circumstances that is for people in their day-to-day life.
Oh, and I also, look, I hate to go here, but you know, my understanding is Georgia's very permissive. I think it's even an open carry state. Imagine how many parents in the wake of Uvalde now, when they hear something at a school, put the firearm in the car with them and run towards the school. Because if you had one, you'd say to yourself, I'm never letting what happened in Uvalde happen to my children.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, September 5th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. To the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, September 6th, Joe Donahue was joined by former EPA Regional Administrator, President of Beyond Plastics, and faculty member at Bennington College, Judith Enck, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Henler, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti.
Let's get started on what is happening in the world. And Hunter Biden pleads guilty in tax case. This is, I think, an interesting story. The guilty plea now exposes President Biden's son to a likely outcome that once seemed unthinkable, significant time behind bars. Hunter Biden pleaded guilty on Thursday to 9 federal tax charges in Los Angeles after telling his legal team that he refused to subject his family to another round of anguish and humiliation after a gut-wrenching gun trial in Delaware 3 months ago. The dramatic development signaled the final stages of a fraught investigation of more than 5 years into the period when Mr. Biden bankrolled his uncontrollable drug and alcohol addiction by leveraging his last name into lucrative overseas consulting contracts and not paying taxes. This was a plea without a deal, a unilateral decision by defense lawyers persuaded they could not prevail in the trial and not part of a settlement that included a reduced punishment. Mr. Biden, speaking in a low and clipped voice as he sat at the defense table, repeated the word guilty 9 times as Judge Mark Scarsi ticked off each of the charges. He will remain free on bond until a sentencing hearing in mid-December. The plea now exposes President Biden's son to a likely outcome that seemed unthinkable just a year ago when his lawyers were on the cusp of a no-prison plea agreement. Significant time behind bars. He now faces a maximum prison sentence of up to 17 years or a fine of up to $1.3 million on top of the possible sentence of 25 years after being convicted of lying on a firearms application in Delaware in June. It does appear, at least for now, that he is banking on a parental executive reprieve, as Hunter Biden's team appeared in court listening while every word of his 56-page criminal indictment was read back to him. The White House press secretary told reporters on Air Force One, it's still very much a no when asked if the president planned to pardon his own son. Heather.
So, boy, first I will say, and I, you know, purely for scientific research purposes, I flip back and forth between MSNBC and Fox. And when I was watching Fox yesterday in my office, they were freaking out because supposedly Biden was going to enter an Alford plea, which is like a nolo contendere. It's like you're pleading because you know that it's very unlikely that you'll succeed defending yourself, but it's not an allocution of guilt necessarily. You still get sentenced as if you were guilty, but you don't have to actually, you know, on the record say, yes, I did this. Yes. You know, you basically are saying, I know that I'm not going to win. So it's no contest, basically. And it's not permitted everywhere. New York does permit Alford pleas, but they were freaking out because, the prosecution didn't know anything about this. And it does require the prosecution to consent, and they did not consent. So he then changed his approach and decided to plead straight up guilty and allocute to the underlying facts. But that tells you that, you know, obviously they did not want to move forward with the trial. I think the last trial was fairly excruciating for the family, setting aside the fact that, you know, at the time his father was running for president. Obviously, he's trying to just stave off any additional pain. Doing it without... you know, any promise as to sentence is obviously those are some big dice that you're rolling. He's high profile. And I think the thing that comes to mind for me is in both of these cases, both the gun case and lying on an application for a gun and this case, the sentencing judge has to be very careful because if you give him a super light sentence, it looks like it's because he's a high profile person. He's got money. And we don't want a justice system where people are treated better because they are wealthy. Now, I know you're laughing, but
I was going to say, unless they're former presidents, but we won't go there.
But I think it's really important. The credibility of the justice system is really important. Yeah. And if the judge is doing their job, they need to take that into consideration, which means probably not going to get off with just a slap on the wrist. Yeah. You have to balance that out against, do you really want the justice system to be penalizing someone for something that other people would not be getting even charged? I think on particularly the lying on the gun. Yeah. You know, do you really, is it because the person is high profile? And then it looks like the justice system is weaponized for political purposes. So there's a really interesting balance that needs to be struck. I'd be very curious to see what happens in both of these cases. I mean, my experience as a public defender and working in the district attorney's office, I don't think he's going to do any significant time. Maybe he'll do home confinement with probation or something like that. Then you can kind of hang, you know, he's got to stay sober. He's got to stay on track out there. But I'd be afraid that there'd be a temptation to sentence him to incarceration, even though he's not a threat to society, right? Like, what would be the purpose of that? So, anyways, that's my very long-winded answer. Sorry.
Not at all. Judith Enck.
Well, I think the saddest people yesterday were not only the Biden family and Hunter Biden, but the producers and the bookers at Fox News. Because what are they going to talk about for the next couple months? They have really, the right-wing media has latched on to this like it is the crime of the century. It is a crime. I mean, Hunter Biden failed to pay $1.4 million in federal taxes over a three-year period. He has since paid the taxes. He's got separate problems with the felony gun violations in Delaware. And a lot of this happened when he was really struggling with drug and alcohol addiction. You know, this is one of the many, many problems when people have drug and alcohol problems. They don't pay their taxes on time. But he was making a lot of money to, you know, as a political consultant to have that high a tax rate. I have to admit, I'm completely disinterested in this story. However, I did pay attention yesterday, and two things stood out to me. One is President Joe Biden has said consistently he's not going to pardon his son. And I think that's the what he believes today. But, man, this is, you know, this is a guy who is all in on his family, and this is going to be hard for him in his final days of the presidency. And I don't know if there'll be sentencing and if there's jail time known by mid-January or not. But the second thing that really struck me is how common tax evasion is in this country, and yet only 363 people were sentenced for tax fraud in the whole country last year. That does not suggest that the IRS and the Justice Department are particularly active in terms of enforcing the tax laws on the country. And if they are really looking for the big fish, Hunter Biden is certainly high profile, and you need to make the point that no one is above the law, cough, cough. But, you know, how about going after very large violators of the tax code? And I would like a House congressional investigation on why only 363 people were sentenced for tax fraud last year in the country. And this is according to the Sentencing Commission.
Aaron.
Yeah, so, yeah, I agree with Judith that this is, I think the bigger picture here is that Republicans have been using Hunter because it's just convenient as a political tool to try to place Joe Biden in the center of a family crime syndicate. They failed to, you know, find any evidence against the president, which would have discredited him in a reelection campaign. So since that failed, now the goal is to just to make the Biden family pay. And that serves a really important purpose in terms of discouraging people, particularly Democrats, from running for office. Because if you run for office, it's very clear that the Republicans have weaponized the judicial system to go after anyone and anyone for anything, no matter how weak the charges are. So, you know, if they're really concerned about tax evasion, start looking at, you know, how Wall Street traders pay their taxes. It would be a lot more lucrative for the IRS, and I think you would find a lot more criminal activity there than you would for what happened with Hunter Biden. So to me, to quote Abraham Lincoln, that this whole, both the gun charge and the tax evasion charge, are thinner than the soup made from the shadow of a starving pigeon.
Say that again.
These charges are thinner than the soup made from the shadow of a starving pigeon.
I like that. That should be on a pillow. I like it. Jim Handler.
Yeah, you know, I'm also of the yawning over the story part. I do understand some of these implications. But I do think one of the most interesting things in here is, despite every effort the Republicans made to tie Joe Biden to the case, nothing has emerged. Nothing in these pleas. Nothing in the trials. It's very clear that Hunter was taking advantage of the name. I will point out that there are other children of other presidents who have done significantly worse and don't seem to be being targeted by the Republicans. For example, a $2 billion, $2 billion, $20 billion, whatever, Saudi deal for the children of one of the former presidents who's currently running for reelection. So again, I just have a, you know, it just feels very much like everyone said. It was a story that only had legs because of politics. Those politics are now significantly less important. You know, in the best case for, well, best, worst, whichever way you look at it, even if Biden were to pardon Hunter, which I doubt personally he would do just because of his personal ethics, that you know, it won't even happen before the election. So it's not an election issue except as speculation. So, you know, I really see it's become a non-issue. I looked at the stories today and was like, you know, this one just seems to be one that just ties a bow around something that the Republicans have been trying to do for a long time. And I agree with Judith, you know, it's the now the right wing is going to have to find something else to go after.
So I have a couple observations. One, first, the idea that the fact that there are only 300 and some odd sentences for tax fraud to me is not at all surprising because the vast majority of those cases are resolved civilly. There's never a criminal approach to it that, you know, they're routinely audited. I mean, I have members who have gone through these endless audits where as soon as the audit ends, they're audited again. And they very rarely are they criminally prosecuted because in the vast majority of cases, there's an agreement reached by the person who maybe underpaid or didn't pay their taxes, which is very different than not reporting income at all. And that's, I mean, in this instance, he didn't report income at all. That same thing is true of virtually every person who's arrested for felony drug sales. I mean, they don't, you know, sell the drugs, you know, and not report the income and then get prosecuted for tax fraud. It's
very 1099.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, so that's, I mean, I'm not at all surprised that that number is low because there's the goal of the system is for people to actually pay what they owe. Right. The other thing I wanted to say is it was funny hearing Aaron talk about weaponizing the justice system. I mean, there's another person who's used those exact same terms.
Yeah,
and that's one of the big problems here is you have it has to be credible. And, you know, if they had just given him a pass and not charged him with anything, I think there's an argument that it's because of his profile. And look, the president's son doesn't get prosecuted for this when ordinary people would now. But do ordinary people really get prosecuted for this? That's the other question. Well, I mean, the history is rife with examples of high profile people not being charged with things. I mean, Elliot Spitzer comes immediately to mind. You know, there was a huge contingent of people who were very upset that he wasn't charged with violating the same law that he actually wrote. You know, so
well, he did resign his position as governor.
I would say
that's more significant than a couple years in jail.
I don't know about that. I mean, the thing is resignation. I get it, elected official, but Hunter Biden wasn't an elected official, so he doesn't have the option of resigning. I don't think you should be able to get off the hook for a criminal prosecution just because you hold office and, you know, you have this other thing that you can do. I don't think that's fair either. So, but anyways, I digress. I think the argument could be made both ways.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 6th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This coming Tuesday, September 10th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., we'll present a WAMC Locked Box pre-presidential debate panel special. Joe Donahue will host an extra special evening broadcast as we, WAMC, the listenership, and the country, get warmed up to watch the first presidential debate between sitting vice president and Democratic candidate Kamala Harris and former president and Republican candidate Donald Trump. We will also be raising funds for WAMC's Locked Box. To learn more, visit wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.